and they challenged each other for about 30 seconds. Then the animal gave a short, muttering growl and returned to its gnawing. Sister and Artie gave it a wide berth, and they kept looking back until they'd rounded a curve and the thing was out of sight. Sister shuddered under her weight of clothes. The beast's eyes had reminded her of Doyle Halland's. Her fear of Doyle Halland was worst when darkness fell, and there seemed to be no regularity to the coming of darkness, no twilight or sense of the sun going away. The darkness might fall after 2 or 3 hours of gloom, or it might hold off for what seemed like 24 hours. But when it did fall, it was absolute. In the dark, every noise was enough to make Sister sit up and listen, her heart pounding and cold sweat popping up on her face. She had something the Doyle Halland thing wanted, something he didn't understand, as she certainly did not, but that he'd vowed to follow her to get. And what would he do with the glass ring if he got it? Smash it to pieces? Probably so. She kept looking over her shoulder as she walked, fearful of seeing a dark figure coming up behind her, its face malformed with jagged teeth showing in a shark-like grin. "I'll find you," he'd promised. "I'll find you, bitch." The day before, they'd sheltered in a broken-down barn and had made a small fire in the hay. Sister had taken the glass ring from her duffel bag. She'd thought of her future predicting glass eight ball, and she'd mentally asked, "What's ahead for us?" Of course, there was no little white polyhedron surfacing with all-purpose answers, but the colors of the jewels and their pulsing, steady rhythm had soothed her. She'd felt herself drifting, entranced by the glow of the ring, and then it seemed as if all her attention, all her being, was drawn deeper and deeper into the glass, deeper and deeper, as if into the very heart of fire. And then she'd gone dreamwalking again, across that barren landscape where the dome of dirt was and the Cookie Monster doll lay waiting for a lost child. But this time it was different. This time, she'd been dreamwalking toward the dome with a sensation of her feet not quite touching the earth when she suddenly stopped and listened. She thought she'd heard something over the noise of the wind, a muffled sound that might have been a human voice. She listened, strained to hear it again, but couldn't. And then she saw a small hole in the baked ground, almost at her feet. As she watched, she imagined that she saw the hole begin to widen and the earth crack and strain around it. In the next moment, yes, yes, the earth was cracking and the hole was getting larger, as if something was burrowing underneath it. She stared, both fearful and fascinated, as the sides of the hole crumbled, and she thought, "I'm not alone." From the hole came a human hand. It was splotched with gray and white, a large hand, the hand of a giant, and the thick fingers had clawed upward like those of a dead man digging himself out of a grave. The sight had startled her so much that she jerked backward from the widening hole. She was afraid to see what kind of monster was emerging, and as she ran across the empty plain, she'd wished frantically, "Take me back, please, I want to go back where I was." And she was sitting before the small fire in the broken-down barn. Artie was looking at her quizzically, the raw flesh around his eyes like the Lone Ranger's mask. She told him what she'd seen, and he asked her what she thought it meant. Of course, she couldn't say. Of course, it was probably just something plucked from her mind, perhaps a response to seeing all the corpses on the highway. Sister had put the glass ring back in her duffel bag, but the image of that hand stretching upward from the earth was burned into her brain. She couldn't shake it. Now, as she trudged through the snow, she touched the ring's outline in the canvas bag. Just knowing it was there reassured her, and right now that was all the magic she needed. Her knees locked. Another wolf, or wild dog, or whatever it was, stood in the road before her, about 15 feet away. This one was skinny, with raw red sores on its hide. Its eyes bored into hers, and the lips slowly pulled away from the fangs in a snarl. "Oh, shit," was her first reaction. This one looked hungrier and more desperate than the other, and behind it, in the gray snow, were two or three more, loping to the right and left. She looked over her shoulder past Artie. Two more wolf shapes were behind them, half hidden by the snow, but near enough that Sister could see their outlines. Her second reaction was, "Our butts are hamburg—" Something leapt from the left, a blur of motion, and slammed into Artie's side. He yelled in pain as he fell, and the beast, which Sister thought might have been the reddish-gray animal they'd seen feasting on a corpse, grabbed part of Artie's knapsack between its teeth and violently shook its head back and forth, trying to rip the pack off. Sister reached down to grasp Artie's outstretched hand, but the beast dragged Artie about 10 feet through the snow before it let go and darted off just to the edge of visibility. It continued to circle and lick its chops. She heard a guttural growl and turned just as the skinny animal with the red sores leapt for her. It struck her shoulder and knocked her sprawling, the jaws snapping shut inches from her face with a noise like a bear trap cracking together. She smelled rotted meat on its breath, and then the animal had the right sleeve of her coat and was tearing at it. Another beast fainted in from the left, and a third darted boldly forward and grabbed her right foot, trying to drag her. She thrashed and yelled. The skinny one spooked and ran, but the other one pulled her on her side through the snow. She grasped the duffel bag in both arms and kicked with her left boot, hitting the beast 3 times in the skull before it yelped and released her. Behind her, Artie was attacked by two at once from opposite sides. One caught his wrist, the teeth almost meeting flesh through his heavy coat and sweater, the second snapping at his left shoulder and worrying him with a frenzied surge of strength. "Get off! Get off!" he was screaming as they strained at each other to pull him in different directions. Sister tried to stand. She slipped in the snow, fell heavily again. Panic hit her like a punch to the gut. She saw Artie being dragged by an animal that held his wrist, and she realized the beasts were trying to separate them, much like they might separate a herd of deer or cattle. As she was struggling up, one of the things lunged in and grabbed her ankle, dragging her another few yards from Artie. Now he was just a struggling form surrounded by the shapes of the circling animals in the swirling gray murk. "Get away, you bastard!" she shouted. The animal jerked her so hard she thought her leg had popped from its socket. With a scream of rage, Sister swung the duffel bag at it, clipping its snout, and the thing turned tail. But a second later, another one was straddling her, its fangs snapping for her throat. She threw her arm up, and the jaws clamped onto it with brutal force. The wolf dog started shredding the cloth of her coat. She swung her left fist at it, caught it in the ribs, and heard it grunt, but it kept tearing through the coat, now reaching the first layer of sweater. Sister knew this son of a bitch wasn't stopping until he tasted meat. She hit it again and tried to wrench free, but now something had her ankle again and was pulling her in another direction. She had the crazy mental image of saltwater taffy being stretched until it snapped. She heard a sharp crack and thought that this time her leg had broken. But the beast that was worrying her shoulder yelped and jumped, running madly off through the snow. There was a second crack, followed closely by a third. The wolf dog that had her ankle shuddered and shrieked, and Sister saw blood spewing from a hole in its side. The animal let her go and began to spin in a circle, snapping at its tail. A fourth shot rang out. Sister realized the beast had been pierced by a bullet, and she heard an agonized howling over where Artie Wisco lay. Then the others were fleeing, slipping and sliding and crashing into one another in their haste to escape. They were gone from sight within 5 seconds. The wounded animal fell on its side a few feet away from Sister, its legs kicking frantically. She sat up, stunned and dumbfounded, and saw Artie struggling to rise too. His feet went out from under him, and he flopped down again. A figure, wearing a dark green ski mask, a beat-up brown leather jacket, and blue jeans, glided past Sister. He had on snowshoes laced around battered boots, and slung around his neck was a cord that pierced the necks of three empty plastic jugs, knotted at the ends to keep them from sliding off. On his back was a dark green hiker's pack, a bit smaller than the one Sister and Artie carried. He stood over Sister. "You okay?" His voice sounded like steel wool scrubbing a cast iron skillet.
"Yeah, I think so."
She had bruises on bruises, but nothing was broken. He planted the rifle he was carrying, butt first, in the snow, then unwrapped the cord that held the plastic jugs from around his shoulder. He set these down, too, near the still-kicking animal. His pack was shrugged off, and then he unzipped it with gloved fingers and took out an assortment of various-sized Tupperware bowls with sealed plastic lids. He set them in an orderly row in the snow before him. Artie came trudging toward them, holding his wrist. The man with the ski mask looked up quickly and then continued his work, taking off his gloves and untying one of the knots in the cord so he could slide the jugs off.
"Son of a bitch, get you?" he asked Artie.
"Yeah, gash my hand. I'm okay, though. Where'd you come from?"
"That way."
He jerked his head toward the woods, then began to uncap the plastic jugs with rapidly reddening fingers. The animal was still kicking violently. The man stood up, pulled his rifle out of the snow, and began to smash the animal's skull in with the weapon's butt. It took a minute to finish, but then the beast made a muffled, moaning sound, trembled, and lay still.
"I didn't think anybody else would be coming this way," the man said. "Thought everybody was long gone by now."
He knelt again next to the body, took a knife with a long, curved blade from a pouch at his belt, and cut a slit in the gray underbelly. The blood gouted. He reached for one of the plastic jugs and held it beneath the stream. The blood pattered merrily in, rapidly filling up the jug. He capped it, put it aside, and reached for another as Sister and Artie watched with sickened fascination.
"Thought everybody else must be dead by now," he continued, paying close attention to his work. "Where are you two from?"
Detroit,
Artie managed to say.
"We came from Manhattan," Sister told him. "We're on our way to Detroit."
"You run out of gas? Have a blowout?"
"No, we're walking."
He grunted, glanced at her, and then went back to his task. The stream of blood was weakening.
"Long way to walk," he said. "Hell of a long way. Especially for nothing."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that there's no Detroit anymore. It was blown away, just like there's no Pittsburgh or Indianapolis or Chicago or Philadelphia anymore. I'd be surprised if any city's left. By now, I guess the radiation's done a number on the little towns, too."
The flow of blood had almost stopped. He capped the second jug, which was about half full, and then he carved a longer slit in the dead animal's belly. He thrust his naked hands into the steaming wound up to his wrists.
"You don't know that," Artie said. "You can't know that."
"I know," the man replied, but he offered nothing more. "Lady," he said, "start opening those Tupperware bowls for me, will you?"
She did as he asked, and he started pulling out handfuls of bloody, steaming intestines. He chopped them up and began filling the bowls.
"Did I get that other bastard?" he asked Artie.
"What?"
"The other one I shot at. I think you'll remember that it was chewing on your arm."
Oh, right, yeah.
Artie watched the guts being stuffed into brightly colored Tupperware bowls.
No, I mean, I think you hit him, but he let me go and ran off.
"They can be tough motherfuckers," he said.
And then he began to carve the animal's head from its neck.
"Open that big bowl, lady," he told her.
He reached up into the severed head, and the brains plopped into the big bowl.
"You can put the lids on now," he said.
Sister did, about to choke on the coppery smell of blood. He wiped his hands on the beast's hide and then slid the two jugs back on the cord and retied the knot. He put his gloves back on, returned the knife to its pouch and the filled Tupperware containers to his pack, and then rose to a standing position.
"You two got any guns?"
"No," Sister said. How about food?
We've got some canned vegetables and fruit juice and some cold cuts, too.
Cold cuts? He repeated disdainfully. Lady, you can't go very far in this weather on cold cuts. You say you've got some vegetables? I hope it's not broccoli. I hate broccoli.
No, we've got some corn and green beans and boiled potatoes.
Sounds like the makings of a stew to me. My cabin's about 2 miles north of here as the crow flies. If you want to go back with me, you'll be welcome. If not, I'll say, have a good trip to Detroit.
What's the nearest town? Sister asked.
St. John's, I guess. Hazleton's the nearest town of any size, and that's about 10 miles south of St. John's. There may be a few people left, but after that flood of refugees washed in from the east, I'd be surprised if you'll find much in any town along I-80. St. John's is about 4 or 5 miles west.
The man looked at Artie, who was dripping blood onto the snow.
Friend, that's going to attract every scavenger within smelling distance, and believe me, some of those bastards can sniff blood a long, long way.
We ought to go with him, Artie said to Sister. I might bleed to death.
I doubt it, the man countered. Not from a scratch like that. It'll freeze up pretty soon. But you'll have a blood smell on your clothes. Like I say, they'll come out of the mountains with knives and forks between their teeth. But you do what you want to do. I'm hitting the trail.
He shrugged into his pack, wrapped the cord around his shoulder, and picked up his rifle.
Take care, he said,
and he started gliding across the snowy highway toward the woods. It took Sister about 2 more seconds to make up her mind.
Wait a minute,
he stopped.
Okay, we'll come with you, mister.
But he was already moving again, heading into the edge of the dense forest. They had no choice but to hurry after him. Artie looked over his shoulder, terrified of more lurking predators coming up behind him. His ribs ached where the beast had hit him, and his legs felt like short pieces of soft rubber. He and Sister entered the woods after the shuffling figure of the man in the ski mask and left the highway of death behind. Chapter 31 The outlines of small, blocky, one-story buildings and red brick houses began to appear from the deepening scarlet gloom. A town, Josh realized, thank God. The wind was still shoving mightily at his back, but after what seemed like 8 hours of walking yesterday and at least 5 today, he was about to topple to the ground. He carried the exhausted child in his arms, as he had for the past 2 hours, and walked stiff-legged, the soles of his feet oozing with blisters and blood in shoes that were coming apart at the seams. He thought he must look like a zombie, or like the Frankenstein monster, carrying the fainted heroine in his arms. They spent last night in the windbreak of an overturned pickup truck. Bound-up bales of hay had been scattered around, and Josh had lugged them over to build a makeshift shelter that would contain their body heat. Still, they'd been out in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by wasteland and dead fields, and both of them had dreaded first light because they knew they had to start walking again. The dark town, just a scatter of wind-ravaged buildings and a few widely spaced houses on dusty lots, beckoned him onward. He saw no cars, no hint of light or life. There was a Texaco station with one pump and a garage whose roof had collapsed. A sign flapping back and forth on its hinges advertised Tucker's Hardware and Feeds, but the store's front window was shattered and the place looked bare as Mother Hubbard's cupboard. A small cafe had also collapsed, except for the sign that read Good Eats. Every step and exercise in agony, Josh walked past the crumbled buildings. He saw that dozens of paperback books lay in the dust around him, their pages flipping wildly in the restless hand of the wind, and to the left were the remains of a little clapboard structure with a hand-painted Sullivan Public Library sign. Sullivan, Josh thought. Whatever Sullivan had once been, it was dead now. Something moved at the corner of his vision. He looked to the side, and something small, a jackrabbit? He wondered. darted out of sight behind the ruins of the cafe. Josh was stiff with cold, and he knew Swan must be freezing, too. She held onto that Cookie Monster doll like life itself and occasionally flinched in her tormented sleep. He approached one of the houses, but stopped when he saw a body curled up like a question mark on the front porch steps. He headed for the next house, further along and across the road. The mailbox, supported on a crooked pedestal, was painted white and had what appeared to be an eye with upper and lower lids painted on it in black. The hand-lettered name was Davy and Leona Skelton. Josh walked across the dirt lot and up the porch steps to the screen door. "Swan," he said, "wake up now." She mumbled, and he set her down. Then he tried the door but found it latched from the inside. He lifted his foot and kicked at its center, knocking it off its hinges, and they crossed the porch to the front door. Josh had just put his hand on the knob when the door flew open and the barrel of a pistol looked him in the eyes.
"You broke my screen door," a woman's voice said in the gloom.
The pistol did not waver.
"Ah, oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. I didn't think anybody was here."
"Why'd you think the door was locked, then? This is private property."
"I'm sorry," Josh repeated.
He saw the woman's gnarled finger on the trigger.
I don't have any money," he said. "I'd pay you for the doll if I did."
"Money!"
She hawked and spat past him.
"Money ain't worth nothing no more. Hell, a screen door is worth a bag full of gold, fella. I'd blow your damn head off if I wouldn't have to clean up the mess."
If you don't mind, we'll just go on our way."
The woman was silent. Josh could see the outline of her head, but not her face. Her head angled towards Swan.
"A little girl," she said softly. "Oh, my Lord, a little girl."
"Leona,"
a weak voice called from inside the house.
"Leo."
And then it was interrupted by a strangling, terrible spasm of coughing.
"It's all right, Davy," she called back. "I'll be there directly."
She turned her attention to Josh again, the pistol still stuck in his face.
"Where'd you two come from? Where you going?"
"We came from out there,"
he motioned toward one end of the town.
"And I guess we're going that way,"
he motioned to the other end.
"Not much of a travel plan."
"I don't guess it is," he agreed, uneasily watching the black eye of that pistol.
She paused, looked down at the little girl again, and then sighed deeply.
"Well," she finally said, "since you're halfway broke in already, you might as well come on in the rest of the way."
She motioned with the gun and retreated through the doorway. Josh took Swan's hand, and they entered the house.
"Shut the door," the woman said. "Thanks to you, we'll be up to our ears in dust pretty soon."
Josh did as she asked. A small fire was burning in the fireplace, and the woman's squat figure was outlined in red as she moved about the room. She lit a hurricane lantern on the mantel, then a second and third lantern, placed strategically around the room to give the most light. The pistol was uncocked, but she kept it at her side. She finished with the lanterns and turned around to get a good look at Josh and Swan. Leona Skelton was short and wide, wearing a thick pink sweater atop ragged overalls and furry pink slippers on her feet. Her square face appeared to have been carved from an apple, then dried under the sun. There wasn't a smooth place on it for all the winding cracks and ravines. Her large, expressive blue eyes were surrounded by webs of wrinkles, and the deep lines in her broad forehead looked like a clay etching of ocean waves. Josh figured she was in her mid to late 60s, though her curly, swept-back hair was dyed garish red. Now, as her gaze wandered between Josh and Swan, her lips slowly parted, and Josh saw that several of her front teeth were silver.
"God Almighty," she said quietly. "You two got burnt, didn't you? Oh, Jesus. I'm sorry, I don't mean to stare, but..."
She looked at Swan, and her face seemed to compress with pain. There was a glimmer of tears in her eyes.
"Oh, Lord,"
Leona whispered.
"Oh, my Lord, you two have been hurt so bad."
"We're alive," Josh said. "That's what counts."
"Yes,"
she agreed, nodding. Her eyes found the hardwood floor.
"Forgive my rudeness. I was brought up better than that."
"Leona,"
the man rasped, and again he was savaged by a fit of coughing.
"I'd best see to my husband," she said,
leaving the room through a hallway. While she was gone, Josh looked around the room. It was sparsely furnished, with unpainted pine furniture and a threadbare green throw rug in front of the fireplace. He avoided peering into a mirror on one wall and walked toward a glass-fronted cabinet nearby. On the cabinet's shelves were dozens of crystal spheres of varying sizes, the smallest about pebble-sized and the largest as big as both of Josh's fists clenched together, about half as big as a bowling ball. Most of them were the size of baseballs and perfectly clear, though others held tints of blue, green, and yellow. Added to the collection were different kinds of feathers, some dried-out corn cobs with multicolored kernels, and a couple of fragile-looking, almost transparent snakeskins.
"Where are we?"
Swan asked him, still hugging her cookie monster. Beneath her eyes were dark purple hollows of fatigue, and thirst burned the back of her throat.
"A little town called Sullivan. There's not much here. Looks like everybody's already gone except these people."
He approached the mantel to examine some framed Polaroids displayed there. In one of the pictures, Leona Skelton was sitting on a porch swing with a smiling, stout, middle-aged man who had more belly than hair, but his eyes were young and a bit mischievous behind wire-rimmed spectacles. He had his arm around Leona, and one hand appeared to be creeping toward her lap. She was laughing, her mouth full of silver flash, and her hair wasn't quite as red. In any event, she appeared to be at least 15 years younger. In another picture, Leona was rocking a white cat in her arms like a baby. The cat's feet stuck up contentedly in the air. A third picture showed the pot-bellied man with a younger fellow, both of them carrying fishing rods and displaying bite-sized fish.
"That's my family," Leona said, coming into the room. She had left the gun behind. "My husband's name is Davy, our son's named Joe, and the cat's called Cleopatra. Was called Cleopatra, I mean. I buried her about 2 weeks ago, out back. Put her deep so nothing could get at her. Have you two got names, or were you hatched?"
I'm Josh Hutchins. This is Sue Wanda, but she's called Swan."
"Swan," Leona said. "That's a pretty name. I'm pleased to meet the both of you."
"Thank you,"
Swan said, not forgetting her manners.
"Oh, Lordy."
Leona bent and picked up some farming and house beautiful magazines that had tumbled off the coffee table, and then she took a broom from the corner and started sweeping dust toward the fireplace.
"House is a god-awful wreck," she apologized as she worked. "Used to be able to keep it as neat as a needle, but lately time slips away. I ain't had no visitors for quite a number of days."
She swept up the last of the dust and stood staring out a window at the red gloom and the wind-lashed remains of Sullivan.
"Used to be a fine town," she said listlessly. "Had more than 300 people living right around here. Fine people, too. Ben McCormick used to say he was fat enough to make 3 more folks. Drew and Sissy Stimmons lived in that house over there," she pointed. "Oh, Sissy loved her hats. Had about 30 of them. Wore a different hat every Sunday for 30 Sundays, and then started over again. Kyle Doss owned the cafe. Geneva Dewberry ran the public library. And, oh, Lordy, could she talk about books?"
Her voice was getting quieter and quieter, drifting away.
"Geneva said she was going to sit down and write herself a romance someday. I always believed she would."
She motioned in another direction.
"Norm Barkley lived down there at the end of the road. You can't see the house from here, though. I almost married Norman when I was a young thing. But Davy stole me away with a rose and a kiss on a Saturday night, yes, sir."
She nodded and then she seemed to remember where she was. Her spine stiffened, and she returned the broom to its corner as if she were giving up a dance partner.
"Well," she said, "that was our town."
"Where'd they all go?" Josh asked.
"Heaven," she replied, "or hell. Whichever claimed them first, I reckon." "Oh, some of them packed up and lit out," she shrugged. "Where to, I can't say. But most of us stayed here, in our homes and on our land. Then the sickness started hitting folks, and death moved on. It's like a big fist a-knocking at your door. Boom, 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 like that. And you know you can't keep it from coming in, but you've got to try."
She moistened her lips with her tongue, her eyes glazed and distant.
"Sure is some kind of crazy weather for August, isn't it? Cold enough to freeze a witch's tit."
"You do know what's happened, don't you?"
She nodded.
"Oh, yes," she said. "Lee Proctor had the radio going full blast at the hardware store when I was there buying nails and wire to hang a picture. I don't know what station he was tuned to, but all of a sudden there was a god-awful squalling, and this man's voice came on talking real fast about a state of emergency and bombs and all. Then there was a sizzling noise like grease in a hot skillet, and the radio went dead. Couldn't raise a whisper on it. Wilma James come running in yelling for everybody to look up at the sky. We went out and looked, and we seen the airplanes or bombs or whatever they were passing overhead, some of them near about to collide with each other. And Grange Tucker said, 'It's happening, Armageddon is happening,' and he just plopped down on the curb in front of his store and watched those things fly past. Then the wind came and the dust and the cold," she said, still staring out the window. "The sun went blood red. Twisters passed through, and one of them hit the McCormick farm and just took it away, didn't leave nothing but foundation stones. Not a trace of Ben, Ginny, or the kids. Of course, everybody in town started coming to me wanting to know what lay in the future and all." She shrugged. "I couldn't tell them I saw skulls where their faces used to be. How can you tell your friends something like that? Well, Mr. Laney, the postman from Russell County, didn't show up, and the phone lines were down, and there was no electricity. We knew whatever had happened had been a whomper. Kyle Doss and Eddie Meacham volunteered to drive the 20 miles to Matheson and find out what was going on. They never came back. I saw skulls where their faces were, too. But what could I say? You know, sometimes there just ain't no sense in telling somebody their time's about up."
Josh wasn't following the old woman's ramblings. "What do you mean you saw skulls where their faces were?"
"Oh, sorry. I forget that everybody beyond Sullivan don't know about me."
Leona Skelton turned from the window, a faint smile on her dried apple face. She picked up one of the lamps, walked across the room to a bookcase, and withdrew a leather-bound scrapbook. She took it to Josh and opened it.
"There you go," she said. "That's me."
She pointed to a yellowed picture and article, carefully scissored from a pulp magazine. The headline read, "Kansas Seer Foretold Kennedy Death 6 Months Before Dixon." And below that, a smaller line proclaimed, "Leona Skelton Sees Riches, New Prosperity for America." The photograph showed a much younger Leona Skelton, surrounded by cats and crystal balls.
"That's from Fate magazine back in 1964. See, I wrote a letter to President Kennedy warning him to stay out of Dallas because he was giving a speech on television, and I saw a skull where his face was. And then I used the tarot cards and the Ouija board and found out that Kennedy had a powerful enemy in Dallas, Texas. I even got part of the name, but it came out as Oswald. Anyway, I wrote this letter, and I even made a copy of it."
She flipped the page, showing him a battered, almost illegible handwritten letter dated April 19th, 1963.
"Two FBI men came to the house and wanted to have a long talk with me.
I was pretty calm, but they like to have scared poor Davy out of his clodhoppers. Oh, they were silky-talking fellas, but they could look a hole right through you. I saw they thought I was a crazy lunatic, and they told me not to write any more letters, and then they left.
She turned another page. The headline on this article read, "Touched by an Angel at Birth, Kansas Jean Dixon Vows."
That's from the National Tattler, about 1965. I just happened to mention to that writer lady that my mama always told me she had a vision of an angel in white robes kissing my forehead when I was a baby. Anyway, this one came out right after I found a little boy who'd been missing from his folks in Kansas City. He just got mad and ran away from home, and he was hiding in an old house about 2 blocks away.
She flipped more pages, proudly pointing to different articles from The Star, The Inquirer, and Fate magazine. The last article in a small Kansas newspaper was printed in 1987.
"I haven't been doing so well lately," she said. "Sinus trouble and arthritis kind of clouded me up, I guess. Anyway, that's who I am."
Josh grunted. He'd never believed in extrasensory perception, but from what he'd witnessed lately, anything was possible. "I noticed your crystal balls over there."
"That's my most favorite collection. Those are from all over the world, you know. They're real pretty," Swan added. "Thank you kindly, little lady."
She smiled down at Swan, then returned her gaze to Josh.
"You know, I didn't see this thing happening. Maybe I'm getting too old to see much anymore, but I had a bad deep-down gut feeling about that astro-nut president. I thought he was the kind to let too many cooks stir the pot. Davy and me, neither one of us voted for him, no sir."
The coughing rattled from the back room again. Leona cocked her head, listening intently, but the coughing faded, and Leona visibly relaxed once more.
"I don't have much to offer in the way of food," she explained. "Got some old corn muffins as hard as cinder blocks, and a pot of vegetable soup. I can still do my cooking over the fireplace, but I've gotten used to eating food that's as cold as a virgin's bed. Got a well in the backyard that still pumps up clean water, so you're welcome to whatever you'll have."
"Thank you," Josh said. "I think some soup and corn muffins would be pretty fine, cold or not. Is there any way I can get some of this dirt off me?"
"You mean you want to take a bath?"
She thought for a minute.
"Well, I reckon we can do it the old-fashioned way. Heat buckets of water in the fire and fill the tub up like that. Little lady, I expect you ought to scrub up, too. Of course, my drains might clog with all the dirt. And I don't believe the plumber makes house calls anymore. What have you two been doing, rolling in the ground?"
"Sort of," Swan said. She thought a bath, warm water or cold, was a fine idea. She knew she smelled like a pigsty. Still, she was afraid of what her skin might look like under all the dirt. She knew it wasn't going to be very pretty.
"I'll fetch you a couple of buckets, then, and you can pump your own water. Which one wants to go first?"
Josh shrugged and motioned to Swan.
"All righty. I'd help you pump, but I've got to be close to Davy in case he has a spell. You bring the buckets in and we'll warm 'em up in the fireplace. I've got a nice claw-footed bathtub that hasn't nestled a body since this damn mess started."
Swan nodded and said thank you, and Leona Skelton waddled off to get the buckets from the kitchen. In the back bedroom, Davy Skelton coughed violently a few times, then the noise subsided. Josh was tempted to step back there and take a look at the man, but didn't. That coughing sounded bad. It reminded him of Darlene's coughing just before she'd died. He figured it must be radiation poisoning.
"The sickness started hitting folks," Leona had said.
Radiation poisoning must have wiped out almost the whole town. But it had occurred to Josh that some people might be able to resist the radiation better than others. Maybe it poleaxed some right off and slowly crept up on the rest.
He was tired and weak from walking, but otherwise he felt okay. Swan, too, was in pretty good shape, except for her burns, and Leona Skelton seemed healthy enough. Back in the basement, Darlene had been fit and boisterous one day, laid low and scalding with fever the next. Maybe some people could go for weeks or months without feeling the full effects of it, he hoped. But right now, the idea of a warm bath and a meal eaten from a bowl with a real spoon made him delirious. "You okay?" he asked Swan, who stared into space.
"I'm better,"
she replied, but her mind had drifted back to her mama, laying dead under the dirt, and to what Pawpaw, or whatever had taken hold of Pawpaw, had said. What did it mean? What was the giant supposed to protect her from, and why her? She thought of the green seedlings growing from the dirt in the shape of her body. Nothing like that had ever happened to her before. She really hadn't even had to do anything, not even knead the dirt between her hands. Of course, she was used to the tingling sensation, to feeling sometimes like a fountain of energy was coming up from the earth and through her backbone. But this was different. Something had changed, she thought. I could always make flowers grow. Bringing them up from wet earth when the sun shone down was easy, but she'd make grass grow in the dark without water, and she hadn't even tried. Something had changed. And it came to her just like that. I'm stronger than I was before. Josh crossed to the window and peered out at the dead town, leaving Swan alone with her thoughts. A figure caught his attention out there, a small animal of some kind, standing in the wind, its head lifted, watching Josh. A dog, he realized. A little terrier. They stared at each other for a few seconds, and then the dog darted away. Good luck to you, he thought, and then he turned away because he knew the animal was bound to die, and he had a sickened gutful of death. Davy coughed twice and called weakly for Leona. She brought the buckets in from the kitchen for Swan's bath water, and then she hurried back to see about her husband. Chapter 32 Sister and Artie had found a little piece of heaven. They walked into a small log cabin hidden in a grove of naked evergreens on the shore of an ice-skimmed lake and into the wonderful warmth of a kerosene space heater. Tears almost burst from Sister's eyes as she stumbled across the threshold, and Artie gasped with pleasure. "This is the place," the man in the ski mask said. Four other people were already in the cabin, a man and woman, both dressed in ragged summer clothing, who appeared to be young, maybe in their early 20s, but it was hard to tell because both of them had severe, brown-crusted burns in weird geometric shapes on their faces and arms and under the torn places of their clothing. The young man's dark hair hung almost to his shoulders, but the crown of his scalp was burned bald and splotched with the brown marks. The woman might have been pretty, with large blue eyes and the fine bones of a fashion model, but her curly auburn hair was almost all scorched away, and the brown crusted marks lay diagonally, like precise pen strokes across her face. She was wearing cut-off blue jeans and sandals, and her bare legs were also splotched with burns. Her feet were swathed in rags, and she was curled up next to the heater. The other two were a thin, older man, maybe in his mid-50s, with bright blue burns disfiguring his face, and a teenage boy, 16 or so, wearing jeans and a T-shirt with "Black Flag Lives" in untidy scrawled letters on the front. Two small studs were pinned in the boy's left earlobe, and he had all of his rooster-cut orange hair, but gray burn marks streamed down his strong-jawed face as if someone had lit a candle over his forehead and let the wax drip. His deep-socketed green eyes watched Sister and Artie with a hint of amusement. "Meet my other guests," the man in the ski mask said, laying his pack on a blood-stained porcelain counter next to the sink after he'd shut the door and latched it. "Kevin and Mona Ramsey," he motioned toward the young couple. "Steve Buchanan,
toward the teenage boy. "And the most I can get out of the old man is that he's from Union City. I didn't get your names."
"Audie Wisco."
"You can call me Sister," she said. "What's yours?" He peeled off the ski mask and hung it on the hook of a coat rack. "Paul Thorson," he told her, "citizen of the world." He took off the jugs of blood and lifted the Tupperware bowls with their grisly contents from his pack. Sister was shocked. Paul Thorson's face was unmarked by burns, and it had been a long time since Sister had seen a normal human face. He had long black hair flecked with gray, and gray swirled back from the corners of his mouth in his full black beard. His flesh was white from lack of sunshine, but it was weathered and wrinkled, and he had a high, deeply creased forehead and the rough-hewn look of an outdoorsman. Sister thought he resembled a mountain man, somebody who might have lived alone in a shack and come down to the valley only to trap beavers or something. Beneath black eyebrows, his eyes were a frosty gray-blue, surrounded by dark circles of weariness. He shrugged off his parka, which had made him appear a lot heftier than he actually was, and hung that up as well. Then started dumping the contents of the bowls into the sink. "Sister," he said, "let's have some of those vegetables you're carrying around. We're going to have asshole stew tonight, folks."
"Asshole stew?" Sister asked and frowned. What the hell is that?"
"It means you're a stupid asshole if you don't eat it, because that's all we've got. Come on, let's have the cans."
"We're going to eat that?"
Artie recoiled from the bloody mess. His ribs were hurting, and he had his hand pressed on the pain under his coat.
"It's not too bad, man,"
the teenager with orange hair said in a flat Brooklyn accent.
"You get used to it. Hell, one of those fuckers tried to eat me. Serves him right to be eaten by us, huh?"
"Absolutely," Paul agreed, going to work with his knife. Sister took off her pack, opened the duffel bag, and gave him some of the canned vegetables. Paul opened them with a can opener and dumped them into a big iron pot. Sister shuddered, but the man obviously knew what he was doing. The cabin seemed to be only two large rooms. In this front room, along with the space heater, was a small fireplace of rough stones, a fire burning cheerfully within it and throwing off more warmth and light. A few candles melded to saucers and a kerosene lamp were set around the room, which contained two unrolled sleeping bags, a cot, and a nest of newspapers tucked away in a corner. A cast-iron stove and a good-sized pile of split logs stood on the other side of the room, and when Paul said,
"Steve, you can get the stove going now,"
the boy got up off the floor, took a shovel from beside the fireplace, and put burning pieces of wood into the stove. Sister felt a new rush of joy. They were going to have a hot meal.
"It's time now," the old man spoke up, looking at Paul. "It's time, isn't it?"
Paul glanced at his wristwatch.
"Nope, not quite yet."
He continued chopping up the intestines and brains, and Sister noted that his fingers were long and slender. He had artistic hands, she thought, particularly unsuited to the task they were now performing.
"This is your place?" she asked.
He nodded.
"Been living here, oh, about 4 years now. During the summer, I'm the caretaker of the Big Pine ski area, about 6 or 7 miles that way."
He motioned in the direction of the lake behind the cabin.
"In the winter, I cozy on in and live off the land."
He glanced up and smiled grimly.
"Winter came early this year."
"What were you doing on the highway?"
"The wolves go up there to chow down. I go up there to hunt wolves. That's how I found all these other poor souls wandering around I-80. I found quite a few more, too. Their graves are out back. I'll show you if you like."
She shook her head.
"See, the wolves have always lived in the mountains. They've never had reason to come down before. They eat rabbits, deer, and whatever other animals they can find. But now the small animals are dying in their holes and the wolves can smell new food. So they're coming down in droves to Supermarket I-80 for the freshest meat. These people made it here before the snow started falling. If you can call that radioactive shit snow, he grunted with disgust. Anyway, the food chain's been knocked off kilter. No small animals for the big ones to eat, just people. And the wolves are getting real desperate and real brave.
He plopped the hunks of innards into the pot, then uncapped one of the blood jugs and poured the stuff in. The smell of blood permeated the room.
More wood in there, Steve. We want this shit to boil.
Right. I know it's time, the old man whined. It's got to be.
No, it's not, Kevin Ramsey told him. Not until after we've had our food. Paul added the other jug of blood to the pot and began to stir it with a wooden spoon.
You people might as well take off your coats and stay for dinner, unless you want to head for the next restaurant down the road.
Sister and Artie looked at each other, both of them queasy from the smell of the stew. Sister was the first to take off her gloves, coat, and woolen cap, and then Artie reluctantly did the same.
Okay, Paul lifted the pot and put it on one of the stove's burners. Stoke that baby's engine and let's get the fire up.
As Steve Buchanan worked on the fire, Paul turned to a cupboard and produced a bottle that still had a little red wine left in it.
This is the last soldier, he told them. Everybody gets one good jolt.
Wait. Sister unzipped her knapsack again and brought out the six-pack of Olympia beer.
This might go better with a stew.
Their eyes lit up like penny candles.
My God, Paul said. Lady, you just bought my soul.
He gingerly touched the six-pack as if afraid it might evaporate, and when it didn't, he worked one can from its plastic ring. He shook it carefully, was pleased to find it hadn't frozen. Then he popped the tab and tilted it to his mouth, drinking long and deep with his eyes closed in rapture. Sister handed beers to everyone but Artie and shared the bottle of Perrier with him. It wasn't as satisfying as the beer, but it tasted fine anyway. The asshole stew made the cabin reek like a slaughterhouse. From outside came a low, distant howling.
They smell it, Paul said, glancing out a window. Oh, those bastards are going to be all around this place in a few minutes.
The howling continued and grew as more wolf voices added dissonant notes and vibrato.
It's got to be time, the old man insisted after he'd finished his beer. Isn't it?
It's almost time, Mona Ramsey had a gentle, lovely voice. But not yet, not yet.
Steve was stirring the pot.
It's boiling. I think the shit's as ready as it's gonna be.
Great.
Artie's stomach was about to curdle. Paul ladled the stew out in brown clay bowls. It was thicker than Sister had thought it would be, and the smell was heavy, but not quite as bad as some of the things she'd scavenged from garbage bags back in Manhattan. The stuff was dark red, and if you didn't look too closely, you might have thought it was just a bowl of hearty beef stew. Outside, the wolves howled in unison, much closer to the cabin than before, as if they knew that one of their kin was about to go down human gullets.
Down the hatch, Paul Thorson said, and he took the first sip.
Sister tilted the bowl to her mouth. The soup was bitter and gritty, but the meat wasn't too bad. The saliva suddenly flooded into her mouth, and she gulped the hot food down like an animal herself. After two swallows, Artie had begun to go pale.
Hey, Paul said to him, if you're gonna puke, do it outside. One speck on my clean floor and you sleep with the wolves.
Artie shut his eyes and kept eating. The others attacked their bowls, scraping them clean with their fingers and holding them out for more like orphans from Oliver Twist. The wolves howled and clamored just outside the cabin. Something slammed against the wall and Sister jumped so hard she spilled asshole stew on her sweater.
They're just curious, Steve told her. Don't sweat it, lady. It's cool.
Sister had a second bow. Artie looked at her in horror and crawled away, his hand pressed against a throbbing pain at his ribs. Paul noticed, but he said nothing. No sooner had the pot been cleaned out than the old man said irritably,
"It's time! Right now!"
Paul put aside his empty bowl and checked his wristwatch again.
"It hasn't been a whole day yet. Please!"
The old man's eyes were like those of a lost puppy's.
"Please!" "All right." "You know the rules. Once a day. No more, no less. Please! Just this once. Can't we do it early?"
"Ah, shit," Steve said. "Let's go ahead and get it over with." Mona Ramsey shook her head violently.
"No, it isn't time. It hasn't been a whole day yet. You know the rules."
The wolves were still growling outside as if they had their muzzles right up to the cracks in the door. Two or more of them started a gnashing, howling fight. Sister had no idea what everyone in the room was talking about, but whatever it was must be vital, she thought. The old man was near tears.
"Just this once. Just this once," he moaned.
"Don't do it," Mona told Paul, her eyes defiant. "We've got to have rules."
"Oh, fuck the rules." Steve Buchanan banged his bowl down on the counter. "I say we do it and get it over with."
"What's going on here?"
Sister asked, puzzled. The others stopped arguing and looked at her. Paul Thorson glanced at his wristwatch, then sighed heavily.
"Okay," he said. "Just this once. We do it early."
He held up a hand to ward off the young woman's objections.
"We're only going to be about 1 hour and 20 minutes early. That's not enough to hurt."
"Yes, it is,"
Mona was almost shouting. Her husband put his hands on her shoulders as if to restrain her.
"It could ruin everything."
"Let's vote on it then," Paul offered. "We're still a democracy, right? Everybody say aye who wants to do it early."
Immediately the old man shouted,
"Aye!"
Steve Buchanan stuck his thumb up in the air. The Ramseys were silent. Paul paused, listening to the call of the wolves, and Sister could see him thinking. Then he quietly said,
"Aye, the ayes have it."
"What about them?"
Mona pointed at Sister and Artie. "Don't they get votes?"
"Hell no," Steve said. "They're new. They don't get votes yet."
"The ayes have it," Paul repeated firmly, staring at Mona.
1 hour and 20 minutes early won't make a big difference."
"It will,"
she replied, and then her voice cracked. She started sobbing. While her husband held her shoulders and tried to soothe her,
"It'll ruin everything. I know it will." "You two, come with me,"
Paul told Sister and Artie, and he motioned them into the cabin's other room. In the room, there was a regular bed with a quilted cover, a few shelves of paperback and hardbound books, and a desk and chair. On the desk was a battered old Royal typewriter and a thin sheaf of typing paper. Balls of paper were scattered around an overflowing wicker trash can. An ashtray was full of matches, and tobacco ash had spilled from the bowl of a blackbriar pipe. A couple of candles were set in saucers on a little table beside the bed, and a window looked out toward the tainted lake. But that was not all the window revealed. Parked behind the cabin was an old Ford pickup truck, the battleship gray paint flaking off its sides and hood, and red creepers of rust starting to eat through the metal.
"You've got a truck," Sister said excitedly. "My God! We can get out of here."
Paul glanced at the truck, scowled, and shrugged.
"Forget it, lady."
"What? What do you mean, forget it? You've got a truck. We can get to civilization."
He picked up his pipe and jammed a finger into the bowl, digging at a carbon deposit.
"Yeah? And where might that be?"
"Out there, along I-80.
"How far, do you think? 2 miles, 5, 10? What about 50?
He put the pipe aside and glared at her. Then he drew a green curtain shut between this room and the other.
"Forget it," he repeated.
That truck's got about a teacup full of gas in it. The brakes are shot, and I doubt if it'll even crank. The battery was fucked up even on the best of days.
But... She looked out at the vehicle again, then at Artie, and finally back at Paul Thorson.
"You've got a truck," she said, and she heard herself whine.
"The wolves have got teeth," he replied.